Strange Days Indeed is the name of the program. My name is Errol Bruce Knapp, and we go south and west for the remainder of the program. First of all, to the West Coast, out there in Washington State, a returning featured guest tonight is a former magazine editor and now an independent journalist with a special interest in scientific controversies and the politics of knowledge. Terry Hansen has followed the UFO controversy much of his life and has occasionally written about it for various media. He holds a bachelor's degree in biology and a master's degree in science journalism, both from the University of Minnesota. Terry was on the program a couple of weeks ago. We talked about his book, The Missing Times, News, Media, Complicity in the UFO Cover-Up, about how the elements of the U.S. government using standard methods of censorship and propaganda, as well as covert ties to well-known news organizations, attempted to hide the existence and activities of unidentified flying objects from the American public. And the last time Terry was on, we focused on the ICBM Minuteman silos in Montana that were buzzed on several occasions. Some of them were deactivated for a while. It caused a major furor. All the local press covered it, but the New York Times, that prints all the news that's fit to print, decided that that stuff wasn't fit to print. So we spent most of the hour on that program talking about the ICBM silos and the problems that they had. Tonight, I want to bring in one of our regulars here. He's also on the line from his home in New York. John Velez has been actively and very publicly trying to raise the public's awareness and consciousness about the reality of UFOs, their occupants, and more importantly, the reality of the intervention of these beings into our own lives. He's worked in the past for 5 years very closely with Bud Hopkins. He's the founder and moderator and webmaster of the Abduction Information Center, its email list and website. John Velez joins us. Gentlemen, good evening to you both.
Good evening, Errol, and good evening, Terry. It's nice to be with you guys.
Good evening, John.
After you were on last time, Terry, John came on and mention was made on the program of NOVA and the way that PBS program handled their program about alien abduction. I know that John and Bud Hopkins and John Mack all contributed to the program and were just extremely angry at what they saw that went to air.
It goes beyond the NOVA program. I believe 1 to 2 years before they produced the NOVA segment on abductions, that PBS had produced a segment basically debunking UFOs. So that there's a history there of slanting the material, giving the public a biased presentation where conclusions were arrived at and presented. And NOVA wasn't the first.
I was going to say that. I think it goes back quite a long way, doesn't it, Terry, to a program that, was it Walter Cronkite did for CBS?
Yeah, there was a program in 1966 called CBS Reports. It was a regular documentary series, quote-unquote, and CBS did a segment on UFOs called UFOs, Friend, Foe, or Fantasy, and maybe somewhat predictably they concluded that it was all fantasy and pretty much overlooked all of the factual information that was known at that time and that could very easily have been verified by any researcher for CBS or any other news organization if they'd just taken, you know, half a day or so to look into the subject, but they pretty much ignored all that, and their conclusions were foregone, and it's now known for certain that the Central Intelligence Agency was pulling the strings at CBS News during that program.
Do you think that Cronkite himself was a part of this cover-up, or was he an unwitting participant?
Well, that's a very good question, and I suspect we may never know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. All we do know is that Cronkite had really had a kind of pro-government attitude throughout much of his career during his reporting on issues like nuclear power and so forth. He pretty much took a very non-critical attitude toward a lot of the topics he was reporting on. Mm. And his wife had worked in propaganda when he was in Moscow. His wife worked for, I think it was the U.S. Information Agency, which is essentially a U.S. government propaganda organization. So I kind of get the feeling that he sort of thought that propaganda was perhaps not such a bad thing as long as you were, you know, on the right side, quote-unquote. Mm.
Terry, if I might ask, how was CIA involvement determined?
Michael Swords, who's a sociologist at Western Michigan University, I believe, and has done a lot of research on, a lot of academic research on the UFO topic, was going through some personal correspondence files at the Smithsonian, the archives of the Smithsonian Institution, and he found a letter between two former members of the Robertson panel. The Robertson panel, if you know about the history of the UFO controversy, was a panel set up in 1953 to come up with some recommendations as to what should be done about news coverage of the UFO situation. One of the members, Thornton Page, was writing a letter back to former panel secretary Fred Durant and just sort of confided that he, quote, helped organize the CBS TV show around the Robertson panel conclusions.
This is all in writing.
Yeah, it is in writing. Yeah, we actually have the letter from Thornton Page. He was writing it on a train, I think, between New York and Washington, D.C. or someplace like that.
Wow.
The handwritten letter. I guess Michael Swords was just lucky enough to stumble across this in the personal correspondence files at the Smithsonian there. And I think that pretty much makes it very clear that CBS was working with the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, exactly how that relationship worked is, you know, more difficult to answer. I tried to contact Walter Cronkite through CBS News, and you know, I had a long series of questions actually that I wanted to ask him about this and other matters, but they just kind of blew me off and said, "Well, he's too busy to talk about these things." And so I suspect we'll probably never know all the details. But what we do know about CBS was that it had a very long, very close relationship with the Central Intelligence Agency going way back throughout much of the Cold War period, and had cooperated with the U.S. government on a number of other issues like this, not just UFO-related issues, but other issues of national security concern.
It's just very compelling information at all that there's any kind of a connection between a government agency and production people. Without mentioning the corporations or anything, the folks that fund NOVA also happen to do a lot of work for the government as well. It's just that I'm not a real big conspiracy buff. You know, there's just so much wild stuff going around out there about one world governments and the Bilderbergers and the Vatican is involved, and
sure,
it's just this huge convoluted thing. But the fact that the government is hiding this information from the public has, I think, become fairly self-evident for anyone who's taken the time to give it more than just a cursory look.
Yeah.
Because the information is there, the documentation is there, all the links are in place, and like you said, it's kind of hard to prove specifics, you know, that the CIA ordered them to put out some disinformation. But the fact that the connections are in place and documented are very significant.
Yeah, well, let me cite another example of that. There was a famous Armstrong Circle Theater presentation that Donald Kehoe participated in. I can't remember the exact year right offhand. It was in the, I think,
that's
got
to go way back to the 50s or the 60s.
Yeah,
for
it was
that.
In the 50s, I believe. At any rate, Kehoe was given a very tight script that he was supposed to follow on that program, and out of frustration at one point in the program, he broke away from the script and began to read his own comments about the UFO situation, and immediately CBS pulled the plug on his microphone, basically cut him off the air in the middle of the broadcast. And I can't remember the guy's name, but the CBS program director at the time later confided that, you know, the script had been approved by the Air Force in advance, and so that there was no way that CBS could deviate from the U.S. government-approved script. So that's another example of how, you know, quite often these programs are scripted in advance and approved in advance. When you're talking about something with obviously very sweeping national security implications, the TV networks are very conscious of the fact that the U.S. government, first of all, holds their fate in their hands in the sense that they license these broadcast operations.
There's a story that goes back to Roswell. I'm not sure if it was Kevin Randall or Stanton Friedman, but one of the guys that did a lot of investigating into the Roswell incident published in one of their books that the radio station that had originally broadcast out of Roswell, that the Air Force, or the Army Air Force at the time, had captured a flying disc, was threatened to have their license revoked if they didn't stop broadcasting that information.
Yeah.
So that goes back to 1947, that kind of strong-arm tactics.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, you know, I mean, I'm not a conspiracy buff in the sense that I think everything is being controlled and by, you know, shadowy figures and all this. But the fact of the matter is, if you study the history of the large news media organizations in the United States and Britain as well, and probably to some extent in Canada, I imagine, what you find is that they tend to work fairly closely with the various governments to manage the content of what they're putting out. And this really got started in probably a big way back in World War One, because at that time it was there was a widespread opposition to getting involved in World War One, at least in the United States. And it was necessary for the U.S. government and the British governments to undertake a massive propaganda program to get people whipped up about the evil things the Kaiser was doing and so forth, and get people behind the war. And so these relationships between the news media organizations and the U.S. government actually began forming and solidifying in the very early part of the 20th century. And I explain all this in considerable detail in my book. And it just began to become more formal over time. And I think what the situation today is that a lot of these big networks are actually owned by arms contractors that are working, you know,
yes,
very closely with the Pentagon. So that these institutions have just become, you know, almost synonymous.
We keep saying, well, I don't believe in conspiracy, and I'm not really sure that there are cover-ups, but the more that we look into this, the more everything seems to be inextricably interwoven.
Well, can I just explain what I mean by that? I'd like to just kind of define it a little bit. I do believe there's a conspiracy, and I do believe that the government is withholding this information. But I believe that the reason they're withholding the information is for two reasons. Number one, I don't see our president or one of our major generals or leaders from the Pentagon getting up in front of the American public and announcing that there are objects flying around in our skies and we don't know what they are,
mm-hmm,
or where they come from,
mm-hmm,
and that there's nothing we can do about it.
Right.
Admitting impotence is not something that I would expect from the Pentagon or from the White House. And the second reason I believe that they've been withholding this information is that, according to reports, the possibility that they may have physical hardware available that they are retro-engineering and desperately working somewhere in the desert to duplicate this technology, you know, that could be a profoundly good reason for withholding information for security reasons. Maybe they're aware of a threat that the rest of us aren't aware of, and they're trying their best to prepare for it. I don't think that the conspiracy goes to the level that some of the proponents of those theories take it to. But I do believe, yes, that there is a conspiracy of secrecy, but I think the reasons are that they don't want to admit to their own impotence. And that, like I said, maybe they have some technology in their hands that they're frantically working to duplicate, so that at least it puts us on an equal footing technologically with whoever these things or beings are.
Mm.
Yeah, I do think that, I mean, people, if you know anything about business and marketing and so on, it's obvious that people do try to control events. I mean, that's what business is all about. And I think that's what government is all about to a large degree, too. And I would characterize this more as a policy decision rather than a, you know, conspiracy in some all-encompassing sense. If you go back again to the famous Orson Welles broadcast, 1938, when he triggered a nationwide panic by putting on a fictional invasion of Mars on radio. Well, having a radio network that spanned the nation in those days was something that was relatively new, and I think a lot of people in government were quite shocked at the outcome of that program.
Mm.
You know, they probably met with people at CBS and said, look, we just can't allow this thing to happen anymore. We have to have some influence over what you're telling the public about certain important events. In fact, one of the academics who did a study on that, his name was Hadley Cantrell, went to work for the Central Intelligence Agency and CBS News shortly thereafter, and his whole area of expertise was mass psychology and things like that. And I think a certain way of thinking about the world arose over time where the U.S. government just realized that it had to have some input into these large media organizations. And so they began forging more formal relationships between publishers, between network executives, and so on and so forth. And that's just how things got to be where they are today.
The problem with all of that, Terry, is the fact that this phenomena is not keeping a distance. It's not something that the government can stand in between them and the people. The contact has not happened in the classical 50s way where a flying saucer lands in a park in front of the White House or where the leaders of the world's nations have been contacted. According to all indications and reports, this contact is happening on a very personal one-on-one level. My life, my family has been affected by this. Countless thousands of people from all over the world have had their lives turned inside out because of these encounters. And I think it's about time that the people find out that something is going on, and whether they have control over it or not, the people have a right to know.
Well, I agree. I'm not saying that this policy was necessarily or has necessarily worked very well or perhaps even was a good idea, but it's somewhat understandable if you understand the way the media and the government have interacted over time.
Yeah, I agree.
That the government would try to exert some kind of control over what's said about the topic. Mm. Now, I think the policy has actually become counterproductive in the sense that if you look at public opinion polls, people pretty well accept that there is a UFO phenomenon. They may disagree on what it's all about, but generally speaking, I think that the public doesn't really believe the official point of view anymore, and the problem that that raises for the U.S. government is that their credibility is kind of going down in flames, and I don't think it's good for public not to trust its own government any more than it's good for the government not to trust its own people. It's a corrosive, dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the whole direction it's taken, Terry, I mean, it's just across the board. If you look at the news reporting on the most recent, quote, wars that we've had, the involvement in Iraq and all of that, our reporters weren't allowed to report directly anymore. They were getting their news from the Pentagon. Now, that's Russian-style journalism. The restrictions have become tremendous. Control of the media and what goes out to the media has become way, way beyond what it was even 20 or 30 years ago.
Yep.
But also the reach of the media and the immediacy of the media has gone way beyond where it was 20, 30 years ago too, John, on the other side of the coin.
And in tandem, the control.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly agree with that. I think it's time to clean house, and I think that the real journalists out there have to stand up and start being a bit more honest in the way they practice their occupation.
Well, the public relies on them, Terry. I mean, you know, most folks turn to their newspaper or to the local newscasts on cable or regular TV
or radio,
you know, to find out what's happening in the world. And if we can't rely on these folks to deliver that information, then we're all in very, very deep trouble. And by deep trouble, I mean our whole democracy, our whole philosophy and way of life is being threatened by it.
Yep. No doubt about it. I mean, I think I compare the situation to what was happening in the Soviet Union that, you know, before the collapse, there was an attitude among the Soviet people that pretty much anything the government said was a lie. It was just automatically assumed to be a lie because they'd been misled about so many things over a period of many decades. And unfortunately, I see the same thing happening in the United States. I think the U.S. government has begun to behave a bit more like a totalitarian regime in the way it communicates with the American public, and that's not a good trend, I don't think.
It's not a healthy trend.
I want to come around now, gentlemen, if I may, to PBS, the unbiased opinions of PBS as far as UFOs and abductions are concerned. I remember watching back in October of 1982 a PBS broadcast in the Nova series, The Case of the UFOs, and as Terry says in his book here, the case of UFOs, the BBC Nova joint production, could be more accurately have been called the case of the IFOs, as in identified flying objects, since it spent a huge amount of time on cases that are easily explained.
Yeah, that's right. I think they took the simple cases and it just explained them away. And again, that's kind of what the Robertson panel, CIA's Robertson panel, suggested should be done. They said, well, you know, take something that seems a little bit mysterious at first and then show people how it really isn't very mysterious. And then people will then conclude that, well, there's really nothing to all this. But, of course, if they'd taken on the really tough cases, the cases that stand up where you have extremely authoritative witnesses and good physical evidence and so forth, it would have been much more difficult to do that, and they simply chose not to follow that approach because it wouldn't have worked.
Mm. And it's interesting because one of the people that they had in that program was a professor at Laurentian University in Sudbury up here in northern Ontario, Michael Persinger, who even back then in 1982 was pushing his theory about UFOs being caused by tectonic strain, the rubbing together of two plates under the surface of the earth which caused these lights to pop up. And that was his explanation for UFOs, as I recall.
Fairly elaborate idea, and I don't know of any other scientist of any caliber who supports that theory. I mean, it's an interesting idea, but you know, science is based on corroborating and testing ideas in different contexts and by different people and getting some correlations, and nothing really correlates with Persinger's ideas as far as I'm aware.
Mm-hmm.
It's also an all-purpose salve for Persinger as well, because that's also his explanation for our abduction experiences.
Yeah, it's just
some kind of a brain-induced electrical activity because of tectonic activity in the earth and yada, yada, yada.
Right.
So he spreads that peanut butter on any piece of bread that comes along.
Yeah, and as I often say, if you go down that road, if you make the argument that these experiences are produced by tectonic plate stresses and so on, well, what happens if an airline pilot is flying across the country and there's a shift in the continental crust or something? Is he going to start seeing pink elephants out in front of his airplane or something like that? I mean, it's a kind of argument that just leads to ridiculous conclusions, and it just doesn't make sense.
On the NOVA program that I participated in, they had called on three experts, I believe. It was Elizabeth Loftus, whose pet theory is false memory syndrome, that we're all not accurately recalling what we think we recall. Then there was the late Robert Baker, because I believe he's deceased now, but Robert Baker's theory was that we were all suffering from a form of sleep paralysis. And then there was Persinger, who was on saying that we are all experiencing anomalous electrical activity in our brains that cause us to hallucinate aliens in our bedrooms. And on top of that, the capper was that they brought on Carl Sagan, who's an astronomer, to diagnose us psychologically on air. And Carl Sagan very confidently, and as if he had the authority and expertise to do so, declared that we were all merely hallucinating, that what was happening was not happening in outer space, but in inner space, as he put it, which I thought was unbelievable, coming from someone whose field is not psychology. Although they brought all these experts on, if you stop and you think about it, all of their theories are mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
We're talking about the 1996 NOVA program now, Kidnapped by Aliens.
Right, the abduction episode.
Yep.
If a science journalist can do anything useful in a controversy of this sort, it seems like what they ought to do is ensure that the so-called experts that are brought on to testify about a given topic have done substantial amounts of research directly related to the issue at hand. And, you know, as you mentioned with Elizabeth Loftus, she's done research on false memory syndrome, but as far as I know, at the time she was on that program, she had never done any research into the abduction phenomenon whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
No, these are all academics, Terry. All of these folks operate within a university environment. They rely on grants.
Sure.
They have to publish and publicize their theories, or they don't get funded next year.
Oh, I understand all that. My point is that the journalists, if they're doing their job, ought to ask that question. They ought to say, well, that's an interesting theory, Elizabeth, but have you actually looked at this phenomenon? Have you even interviewed, say, a dozen abductees? And she would have to say, well, no, I haven't. And that would pretty much shoot her down right away. That's the way science is done. You don't call in experts who, in fact, aren't experts.
Right. And the way it was executed on air was that they had taped some interviews with us, with the witnesses, the abductees, and then the way they edited the segments together, they would show Elizabeth Loftus expounding her false memory theory and then cutting in between bits and pieces of our testimony, of our reports, as if Elizabeth Loftus was diagnosing us, as if she was talking about us.
Yeah.
None of those people, and I'm here to testify, not a single one of those people, not Robert Baker, not Elizabeth Loftus, Carl Sagan, or Michael Persinger, ever contacted either myself, any of the other witnesses or the abductees, or Bud Hopkins or John Mack to request an interview with us, to even find out what it was we were reporting. Yet they all went on the air and allowed this sham of a program to go out there representing them and their work as if it was us that they were talking about. And the whole thing was just very, very deceptive and underhanded.
Both Bud Hopkins and John Mack got preview copies of the original cut of the NOVA program.
Yeah, but we had to get that ourselves. They didn't provide it.
I know that you and Bud had to get yours yourselves. Was that the same copy that John Mack got a hold of?
I believe that Bud duped the copy that I secured, and I think I can just say it. I got it from Michelle, from Michelle Deschamps.
Oh, really?
Yeah, God bless Michelle. He contacted me about 3 months before the actual air date and let me know that he had secured an advance copy, a promotional copy that WGBH in Boston was sending around to different stations to preview the program, and was kind enough to send us a copy so that we had at least some advance warning as to what they had ready for us.
I wasn't aware that Michel Deschamps up there in Sudbury in here in Ontario
saved our lives.
Had saved your bacon.
But Hopkins still owes him a book, an autographed book.
Did either you or Bud ever have an opportunity to talk directly with Denise Delaney about that program after the fact?
Oh, my God. Denise Delaney. I spent hours and hours and hours with Denise Delaney.
The producer of the NOVA program.
Yeah, was the segment producer and director, I think, as well.
But after the program aired is what I'm talking about. In other words, were you able to talk to her about
all
why
communications had ceased after I did one promotional radio broadcast with her where I confronted her about the program that they had put together. And after that, she refused to appear on air with me. Let me give you a little background first. NOVA scheduled 17 radio programs for Bud, myself, John Mack, and a couple of his people in order to promote this program before it actually aired. So that in a four-week period, we were booked for 17 different radio and TV programs. What happened was Denise was supposed to appear with me on about 7 or 8 of those broadcasts. And the first one that I appeared on with her, I apparently caught her off guard because she wasn't aware that I had seen the segment, what was going to be put out to the public, and I had. And I confronted her with a laundry list of questions as to why that was produced in that manner. And after not being able to answer or defend herself with a lot of the questions, she out and out refused to appear anymore on air with me.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's an experience that I've had myself, is that once these things are out on the air, they are not willing to defend their decisions about what they've said. I tried to interview William Broad at the New York Times. He wrote a story based on a CIA report that claimed UFO reports were caused by spy planes back in the 50s and 60s and so forth. And basically what he did was he took the CIA report and ran with it and just accepted it as fact without doing any cross-checking or interviewing primary sources or anything like that. And if he had done that, which actually Mark Rodiger did at the Center for UFO Studies, what he would have found out was that the Air Force people in Project Blue Book denied it completely. They said, no, there was no evidence, there was nothing, no truth to that whatsoever, but the CIA was just blowing smoke. But yet the New York Times picked that story up and ran with it and gave it worldwide distribution. And it's just an example of how these large news organizations are so willing to broadcast whatever the intelligence community says without any fact-checking whatsoever. It's totally inexcusable. It shouldn't happen.
Not in a free press.
Not in a free press.
Actually, you mentioned in your own book, I don't know if you had an opportunity to speak to Denise Dionne directly or if you were quoting someone else in the book, but Denise basically was very frightened by the stories we were telling, by what we were reporting,
Yeah. And
didn't want the public to be afraid and wanted to make sure that her program Yeah. Left everybody comfortably feeling that, you know, there's nothing to any of this.
Right. What I said in my book was that it shouldn't be the journalist's job to reassure people and make them feel comfortable. They should be there to tell people what is happening.
To report.
And let people make up their own minds about what kind of response they're going to have to it all.
And that was the shame of that program, Terry. The public was lied to. They were robbed of an opportunity to evaluate what evidence and materials are available for themselves and to make up their own minds. And on top of that, just speaking personally for myself, I felt like I was robbed of an opportunity to get a fair public hearing.
Yeah.
Not just myself, the other witnesses, abductees that participated as well. It was just a tremendous public disservice.
Yeah, it was. As much as I've been quite critical of the news media generally, I have to say that there are occasions where National Public Radio here in the U.S. has done a fairly good job of covering this story. Ira Flatow on his Science Friday program did a fairly reasonable program about the abduction phenomenon about a year or two ago, I think. I was quite surprised, given the emotional overtones of the whole topic, that Ira was able to do a pretty credible, balanced job of reporting it. He had some people on there who had actually done research on the abduction phenomena. They were genuine experts in that sense. It occasionally does get good treatment, and I think when it does get good treatment, we have to recognize that.
Yeah. CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation up here in Canada, had David Jacobs on their Ideas series and did a really good job of covering the abduction phenomena from Jacobs' point of view, too. So that was good.
You also have to mention CDB Bryant.
Oh, yeah, Cordy Bryant.
Cordy Bryant, who did the book on the MIT conference, who actually went down there a complete total skeptic.
Yeah.
I've done a couple of radio broadcasts with Cordy, and I've had several conversations privately with him, and he's a terrific guy. But he was very open and honest with me and told me, John, when I first went down to the MIT conference, I went down there completely skeptical, expecting to write a kind of fluffy piece about the whole thing, but changed his mind when he saw how many serious people were taking the subject seriously. And also, when he had an opportunity to actually meet the witnesses and talk to the people that are reporting the phenomena, he did a complete 180. Anybody who's read the MIT book about the MIT conference on abductions in 1992 can see that Cordy gave a really well-balanced, fair presentation. He's a well-known top-flight journalist.
Cordy's voice does the opening of this program. He's the voice that says, for the first time in history, we're studying something that's studying us.
That's Cordy, yeah.
That's Cordy.
On the line with us, John Velez of the Abduction Information Center, who was a participant in the NOVA program, kidnapped by UFOs or kidnapped by aliens.
No, they didn't want to use aliens because they thought the audience would think we were being kidnapped by Mexicans. I had that in a letter from Denise Dionne because I asked her, I said, why did you choose such a sensational title? Is this just about putting asses in the seats for you, or are you doing science reporting here? And her response was, well, they didn't want to use the word aliens because they thought people, the audience, would think we were being kidnapped by, you know, aliens like Mexicans or Canadians. You know, before we forget, Errol, I want to mention one more tremendous journalist who I've recently fallen in love with, some guy from California named Terry Hansen. who had the courage to write the truth and put it out there in a book, and I want to thank Terry publicly for that.
Well, thanks. I'm in Washington, though, as Errol
Washington.
I was trying to figure out why Nova would produce their program with the slant that they did. I mean, was there any bias on the part of the producer, the segment producer, Denise Dionne?
You know, you can only go by what the producer said. And in an interview after the show, Denise Dionne said something to the effect that I was afraid of what the consequences would be if we acknowledged that this phenomenon was actually happening and there wasn't anything we could do about it. And I think that PSYCOP, which is an organization that had a great deal of influence on the NOVA program, played on those fears of hers psychologically and tried to make the case to her that, boy, you just can't possibly acknowledge that this stuff might actually be happening. And so I think they used psychology on her to a large degree, and it's unfortunate that they didn't have anybody in charge at NOVA who was able to see through that a little bit better.
Okay. So she sails on blithely with her career, still producing there.
Oh, yeah.
I know that I sent emails to the various sponsors of the NOVA program, TRW and a bunch of the corporate sponsors there. Oddly enough, as you were saying earlier on, John, there are defense contractors.
Yeah, so the people that fund the program, I don't want to get any of us into any kind of legal problems. If anybody wants to find out who these corporations are, all they have to do is read the credits at the beginning of the
you can mention the names. I just did. I just said TRW is one.
Right. These are well-known government military contractors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's take another case. Let's suppose that you did a program on the abduction phenomenon where you gave it some credit and said, well, I mean, in a very balanced approach, and say, well, maybe there's really something going on here. We need to study it a little more, something mild like that.
Right.
And it was funded by an arms contractor or somebody with some organization with close ties to the Pentagon.
Mm.
I don't think that they would. I think that they would probably pull their funding from the program, I suspect.
Oh, sure.
There's a lot of kind of institutional ties that influence what comes out in the media, and I mean, that's a lot of what I talk about in the book. It's not necessarily that the CIA is working with PBS in a direct capacity like they were with CBS, but you know there are more subtle ways of influencing content.
Yeah. The book that Terry's talking about is his book, The Missing Times, News Media Complicity in the UFO Cover-Up. Terry Hansen is his name. John Velez is the other guy's name. An email from a compatriot of Michel Deschamps, Todd Frazier, up there in Sudbury. Todd says, it seems like there are similarities between the NOVA program and the special on the faking of the Apollo moon landings. I don't want to spend too much time on the Fox program about the faking of the Apollo moon landings, because despite appearances there, I think there's some evidence that some of the photographs perhaps were not taken on the moon at the time. However, just a bunch of CRAP all around that, which is pretty much what Cordy Bryan had to say about the NOVA program on abductions, as I recall, was a bunch of crap, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I maybe Terry would want to comment on this, but John Mack went and got a lawyer, and they re-edited that program.
Mm-hmm.
Terry, you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think what John Mack's lawyer said in a letter to NOVA was that basically they were doing some things that were potentially libelous. And NOVA will deny this. Of course, they'll deny that they made changes to the program because of that letter. But the fact of the matter is, after they got the letter, they did change the program. John Mack told me that they filmed him and some of the people on the program in sort of questionable circumstances, or what looked like questionable circumstances, a sleazy motel room and so on and so forth, as if there was sort of the implication of something untoward happening.
Tacky.
Of course, that wasn't the case.
Uh-huh. So they, in fact, ended up recutting it because John Mack had threatened to sue. Not science at all. I mean, it's actually extremely puzzling, because they have the bucks. They have the opportunity. They can call anybody they want to come and testify on whatever topic they choose to cover. I loved NOVA. For me, it was the top science program. And when I saw what they did to Hopkins and Mack and John and various other people, and the hatchet job that they did,
I stopped watching NOVA after that because I could not trust them anymore.
Me too, Errol.
I mean, we're all human beings as journalists, I think, and it's possible to let your biases influence how a given program is produced. However, I think if there is a great deal of dissent or a great deal of disagreement about the way a topic is produced, you ought to do some kind of follow-up. Like Bill Moyers did a program just recently about the chemical industry. I don't know if you saw that up there in Canada, but
excellent,
you know, it was very controversial, and they made some very damning charges against the chemical industry. And what Bill Moyers did at the end of the program was he allowed the chemical industry spokespeople to come on and give their side of the story.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good way to handle it. If you're dealing with a subject that everybody agrees is controversial and some very serious charges are being made, then at least allow people to come on and give their side of it. And I think John and Bud Hopkins and a few other people that were on the NOVA program should have been allowed to do that. Give them a half hour or whatever and let them tell their side of the story.
The shame of it is that science is not always what scientists do.
No, that's true.
Yeah, and the proof of the pudding is that program. It was just a complete, total disinformation from beginning to end. It was a real crime against humanity, almost. And we're not naive, Terry. None of us are naive. We went into that hoping, at best, that the program would leave it an open question at the end. Like you said before, if not, in fact, endorsing the phenomena, but to at least leave people with an open question that, you know, there's a genuine mystery here, there's something that needs looking into, we don't have all the answers about this, and to at least have made an effort to present the available evidence and material that guys like John Mack and Bud Hopkins have based their own assessments and conclusions on. And the public wasn't afforded that opportunity.
Yeah, you know, sometimes it's not necessarily the journalist or the producer that's at fault either, John. I don't know what the situation was on the NOVA program, but I've talked to journalists who've tried to report on this story and have simply run into high-level decisions within the newspaper or television station or whatever, and they just say, no, I'm sorry, we're just not going to cover the story, or we're not going to cover it the way you want to cover it. You can rewrite your story to agree with our guidelines. Otherwise, your story is just not going to run. So there are institutional pressures on journalists, and they limit how journalists can report not only UFO stories, but other politically loaded topics as well.
Mm-hmm. Terry, in your own research, how far back have you traced the source of all of this? Because, you know, we keep generalizing and saying institutional pressure against journalists. But ultimately, what is the source of that censorship?
I think ultimately it's government policy, and I think it ripples down to the level of the average journalist in some fashion or other, depending on what institution they're working for. But I spent two chapters of my book talking about the history of censorship and the history of propaganda, and those chapters don't even discuss UFOs at all. They just talk about how the government censors the news and how the news organizations work with the government to censor the news, and also how they work with the government to distribute propaganda. This is not at all an unusual situation with UFOs, by the way. This has happened again and again and again throughout the 20th century, starting with World War I and going forward. So, you know, what I do is summarize all these kind of standard techniques that are used, and then I look at the UFO controversy and show that the same techniques are being used again and again here. So my case is basically that, you know, it's just too great a coincidence to see that these same methods are popping up repeatedly throughout the UFO debate.
The implications of what that man just said are unbelievable.
I'm running.
You're scraping your jaw off the floor.
I said to Palmiro earlier on, you know, there's a long pause sometimes for me, and I'm digesting what was just said and, you know, going through the implications of it, and that is censorship of one form or another.
Tentacles of control.
Exactly. And a lot of the time in the name of national security. Oh, you can't say that. That goes against our security policy.
Yeah, that's like whipping out the Bible for them. You know, that has some kind of sacred, you know, aura about it. You know, the minute, oh, it's in the name of national security, everybody goes, oh, okay.
I think the national security clause has been really terribly
misused
since 1947.
Mm-hmm.
So easy now for government officials to say, well, we just can't talk about that because of national security.
It's classified. Yeah.
There's according to one source, there's about 1 trillion pages of classified material in the U.S. government now. That's a phenomenal amount of material, and it's gotten to the point where even government historians acknowledge that they can no longer write an accurate history of the United States, especially during the last 50 years, because they don't have factual information.
Access to the information.
Ooh, and that amount of paperwork could also be part of the conspiracy, too.
It gets very complicated.
Oh, God. Well, it's like, you know, Malin Space Labs releasing 50, 60,000 images of Mars. Here, guys, go find this stuff. Gentlemen, that's the end of our time, unfortunately.
Wow, that flew by.
Didn't it, though? We're still only scratching the surface. You want to read more about news media complicity in the UFO cover-up? Terry Hansen's book is a book to get a hold of. You may have a little difficulty finding it in the bookstores. However, if you go to www.themissingtimes.com, you can order it online there. Presumably, this will be published up here very shortly, Terry.
Well, you can order it anywhere in North America.
Okay. Good. From www.missingtimes.com. Or you can send a fax to Terry, 206-855-8075. That's 206-855-8075. Gentlemen, John Velez, Terry Hansen, thank you very much indeed for this. You're just helping to expand people's knowledge on this topic.
You're very welcome, Terry. It was a real pleasure to meet you and spend a little time with you.
Yeah, you too, John. Thanks.
And Errol, always, it's always great.
It's always good, John. Thank you. Thanks again to both of you. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye, Errol. Have a good night.
Good night, gentlemen. That's this week's Strange Days Indeed.